Blog Talk Radio.
Paperback writer.
Good evening, everybody. This is the Writer's Lounge, where we showcase new authors, and sometimes we showcase other authors that have been around for a while, which would be the case tonight. And this is show number 149, and this is April 1st, 2024. And my name is Tom Riedel. I am your host, and the co-host tonight, Terry Brown, will not be on, but I'll be here in a brief intro to today's show. We have on Kevin Chapman, who has written the book, The Other Murder, and Kevin will be on at about 15 minutes past the hour, wherever you are. Now, more about us. Here's where you can find us out there. Find us on Facebook, The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. Find the book reviews of all of our current shows over at thomasriedel.net. That's thomasriedel.net in the blog section. And the on-demand radio shows can be found there on the podcast page as well. Or go over to the Blog Talk Radio site and search for The Writer's Lounge, or find us easily on a Google search. Our email is writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. If you want to be a guest on the show, have your book reviewed, put guest request in the subject line and we will get back to you. I've been doing book reviews for over 11 years now, and besides these reviews being posted on my site, I also review on Goodreads and Readsy Discovery. They both do a great deal to help authors and readers alike. If you're a reader of books and are looking for a good book to read, check them out. You will not be disappointed. Upcoming authors on the Writer's Lounge in 2 weeks on April 15th, 2024, Ox DeVere will be here with Rage of the Djinn. A team of excavators restoring Notre Dame makes a stunning discovery beneath the floor of the cathedral, an unmarked sarcophagus. So that should be very exciting. And April 29th, 2024, it is to be announced. We have not lined up an author yet for that show, but that will be coming soon. And when it does appear, just go over to the Facebook site and look for it there. Next segment. This is where I normally introduce my co-host, but she is not here tonight. And this is Writer's Topics. Tonight, we will look at a topic which writers are always told to do in their writing, show, don't tell. We'll play a 10-minute clip that will go more in detail of the subject, and we'll play that in just a bit. But I want to do a self-promotional plug here for myself first, and I am so excited because just the other day I launched my current book, which is The Life and Times of Benjamin Murphy, A Central New York Ghost Story. And if you like ghost stories or you're in Central New York, I think you'll really enjoy reading that. And if you'd like to learn more about that story, go over to my site at thomasridell.net. And now we get on to the next segment of the show. That would be the main event of tonight's show, and it's guest author intro and interview. And again, once again, we've got Kevin Chapman here, who wrote The Other Murder. I want to remind everybody out there, if you're listening live, call in on the phone number if you'd like to talk to Kevin or myself at area code 914-219-0868. That's area code 914-219-0868. We'd love to hear from you. Now my review of The Other Murder. Hannah Hawthorne is a cable news producer intent on covering the shooting of an NYU student. She hopes the story will prove her worth with a news company who has been critical of her in the recent past. The story balloons into a media circus, triggering gun rights protests and vigils for the fallen student. Hannah has regained favor with her boss, but the plot thickens. A murdered Hispanic teen is also found in the same park on the same night as the discovery of the white girl's body. Paulo, a reporter from a small online newspaper, delves into that story and quickly realizes that the two murders are linked, causing a stir of controversy within the community. Paulo and Hannah meet up and decide to cover the sensational story together. But when they discover the facts surrounding the murders, things heat up quickly. When they discover the man who might be the killer, they realize they could be at risk of losing their careers and also their lives. This murder mystery intrigued me, but the story did a lot more than entertain me with a well-written whodunit. It caused me to think about how difficult and intricately woven the police, reporters, and even community members are in being tied into a murder investigation. It's like a system of gears. You remove one and the whole thing falls apart. The other great ingredient of the story is, do you tell the truth or do you avoid it for the greater good? These are all parts of the plot that kept me turning the pages until the very end, and it's what ultimately took this book to a 5-star rating. Kevin Chapman is an exceptional writer, and if you decide to pick up this book, you won't be disappointed. This is one is a must read. And now it is our pleasure to welcome Kevin Chapman to the Writer's Lounge broadcast. And I will go over here and open the door to the magical imaginary studio. And hopefully Kevin is there. Kevin, are you there?
I am, Tom. Glad to be here.
Nice to hear you, sir. And where are you calling from?
Calling in from my home office in Central New Jersey.
Oh, you're not too far away from me. I'm in Central New York.
There you go.
Yeah, we talk to
my
authors.
My stories
all
are mainly
over the world.
Set in New York, so not Central New York, but New York.
Right. Well, that's good. We sometimes like to place them where we're living. It makes it a little bit easier, doesn't it?
Well, I lived in New York for a lot of years, so it's fun for me to write stories that are set in Manhattan and around New York City, which is a font of interesting venues.
Yes, yes. So we know that you're not new to the writing business. You've written several other books as well and won awards in the process. But tell us how it all started for you. What inspired you to be a writer?
Well, I've always been a bit of a closet storyteller and writer from way back. But in my day job as a lawyer, I'm really a writer. I write stories that are based on facts and try to make them interesting for judges and administrative law judges and whatnot.
Yeah.
But I was inspired to write my very first novel back in the late 90s when I had some time off and just decided, let's take a shot at it, and wrote one that is very old now and very outdated, but it was my first foray, and that really got me going. And since then, I've been at it on and off, and really on since about 2016, when the last of my children graduated from high school, and I suddenly found myself with quite a bit of free time on my hands. And I said, let's go and start writing something that's really fun and interesting that people might want to actually read and buy. And that's when I started writing mysteries and thrillers. And it's been fun since then.
Very good. Hey, a thing just popped into my head. When you sat down to write your first story, do you remember how long you were at the wherever you were writing, whether it was freehand or at a computer? Did you spend hours in that first spark of inspiration to write, or did it just come kind of piecemeal after that?
Well, I don't know. I it's a long, long time ago, so I can't remember precisely. I know that I had a lot of time because I had been laid off from my job, and was in my office, and I still had my computer, and I just started tapping away at an outline of what I thought the story might be. But I can imagine I probably was at it for most of the day for several days before I kind of had the outline in very broad strokes put together. But I'm a compulsive outliner, so that's my process.
Oh, okay. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But the criminal justice system, which you were sort of plugged into, not really a criminal, you're not a criminal lawyer, but it can be very chaotic, but you wrote about it in your book. It can be a very chaotic place to navigate through. And The Other Murder shines a bright light on that process. What do you think the general public lacks most in the form of knowledge as to how the criminal justice system works?
Well, I think we all have a pretty good idea from watching good television and good movies about how cops do their jobs and about how lawyers do their jobs. The thing that people probably don't realize is how slow the wheels really turn and how much time goes by between the various elements of any case, whether it's a civil case or criminal case. It has to be condensed for the purposes of telling a story. And so you get the impression that things happen very quickly when, in fact, they really don't. Although the investigation process, from a police standpoint, often does move fairly quickly in the early days, because that's when the evidence is fresh and the witnesses are fresh, and you got to jump on it as quickly as you can, or you start losing information.
Right. And as you know, we live in a microwavable society where everything wants it done right away. And sometimes that process takes a long time in happening. I think it even seems longer when you're in that process as opposed to somebody that might be looking in at it from outside. Like a lot of people, when they turn on the news, they get the soundbite of a trial or whatever's happening. But when you really get into the nuts and bolts, it may have taken months for it to get to that point where they're actually watching it on the news. And that's what I found good about your book, was that it brought that out and let us know that it isn't always a quick process. And there's a lot of, as I said in my review, there's a lot of gears involved in the media, in the court system, in the police, in the prosecution. And all that has to come together, and it's quite a process, really. But it's I think it's the best one we have in America, and I'm really proud to be an American because of that process. And I really enjoyed reading what you had to write. But you're being a lawyer, as you touched on, what do you like? Maybe that's probably a loaded question, but what do you like the most about it, and what do you like the least about it?
Well, my day job can be very interesting, and has a lot of facts and circumstances that keep me busy. That's the fun part. The boring part is a lot of paperwork and a lot of detailed writing and record keeping, and and putting together evidence and documents and witness statements. And that is all part of the storytelling process, but it can get a little tedious from time to time. Fortunately for me, I work for a media company. So I'm involved in the news of the day and the things that are happening behind the scenes in the production of news. And that's fascinating. And I get to get into that some here in The Other Murder, because you have a couple of journalists who are the key players, and you get a little peek behind the curtain at what's going on before the camera rolls and the 30-second or 60-second soundbite comes out for the people on the television. And that's a lot of what I was trying to get to in this story.
That's quite interesting there. As you said, you're involved in media too.
Well, that's the company. I work in-house as a lawyer for a media company.
Do you want to mention a name or no?
Let's not do that for now.
Okay. But that sounds
interesting. I don't want to project that anything in this story is truth, or that is based upon what I do for a living, or for the people that I am engaged with for a living. This is fiction, but it's based on a lot of background and personal information. Early on in this story, you have Hannah Hawthorne, who's the cable news producer, who goes through an elaborate process of trying to find a witness, trying to find a person to step in front of the camera so that they can do their live shoot on the night of this murder in Washington Square Park in Manhattan, and to be able to find a scoop, to find somebody that nobody else has, who has information that nobody else has. And Hannah is very good at it, and she finds this woman and puts her in front of the camera, and that's what sort of sparks this story going into I'll call it a media circus. I mean, I would call it viral if it was online. But it's all the things that go into that starts the ball rolling down the hill.
Yes, and okay, so now let's expand a little bit on some of your other works that you were involved with. Can you tell us some about your other fiction, such as the Mike Stoneman thriller series, and what's it like writing
Stoneman?
Yeah.
Well, I got the first novel I wrote in the genre was called Righteous Assassin, which is a serial killer story starring a New York City homicide detective named Mike Stoneman and his partner Jason Dixon. So the Mike Stoneman book started there, and then it grew into what is now a 5-book series. I'm working on book 6 now. It'll be out this fall. And that's been a lot of fun. The characters have been wonderful to work with. The readers have had a lot of connection to my characters, and the stories have been a lot of fun to come up with. So I wrote those 5, and then I took a break from that and wrote 2 stories that were standalones. The Other Murder is the second of those 2. Before that, I wrote a book called The Other Murder, also set in not The Other Murder. Yeah, I just said that. Called Dead Winter. Dead Winter was set also in New York City. Very different story involving none of the same characters. A totally standalone story. And then I did The Other Murder, and now I'm going back to Mike Stoneman, number 6, this year.
Very good, very good. And then you also do screenplays.
Well, we're waiting for screenplays actually to get bought up. I've done one. I've got another one that kind of got half done and not yet completed. But really, all my books are written in kind of a dramatic screenplay sort of fashion. I like to set scenes and let the readers see what happens. And I try not to have too much that goes on inside the heads of the characters. And everything that you see on the page is what you would see on the screen when you read the books. At least that's what I'm going for.
And that must be quite the challenge to be able to do something like that, right?
You know, it's just my style and my way of talking on the page. I've actually tried to have more of an internal struggle of a character, and it's hard for me. I have a difficult time writing the narration from the point of view of a character thinking but not speaking. Somehow it's just the way my mind works. So I do what comes naturally, I guess, and that's the way it comes out.
And here's something just came to my mind in regards to writing a screenplay. When the actor who is portraying your character is to, you know, like you just talked about, portraying whatever was in his mind, but doing it through words or even facial expressions, do you write in the facial expressions of how the character is supposed to respond to someone?
You wouldn't go into that much detail. It would be you'd have the character's name as the speaker, and then you might give a stage direction like angry or frustrated, and also what motion is happening, you know, moving toward the door, and then you'd write the dialogue. But you'd let the actor figure out what facial expressions or hand gestures or things like that are gonna come into it. For the most part, but you do give emotion. You give context of what is the character feeling when they before they say the line.
Then ultimately, it would probably be up to the director to give it the final clip, right?
Sure, exactly. The screenplay is a lot shorter than the book. And what they say when you're looking at how to write a screenplay, they say that one page of a screenplay is approximately 1 minute of screen time. So you can imagine that a two-hour movie, 120 minutes, you're talking about 120 pages, which is
right.
A lot less than what you would put into a novel because it's very condensed. You have the dialogue and you have the sort of general direction of what's the setting, where are you? You're in a park in Manhattan. It's nighttime. The character looks ahead and sees something and then dialogue. So it's a very different way of writing. But it's the way I think about these things. When I do outlines, I outline each scene in the story. So what's going to happen in this scene? Who's there? What are they going to do? What's going to happen that's important to the story? And then you go on to the next scene. What's the next thing that's going to happen? And that's the way I outline the stories.
Yeah, I often wondered why when we go to movies, most of them are right around the two-hour mark. Is it probably because that attention spans kind of, you know, go away after
tell that to
hours.
James Cameron. Yeah, I
yeah,
I think two yeah. hours is just a convenient amount of time for marketing and for movie theaters, and you know, it's the right amount of time to be in a movie theater to watch a movie. So anything from an hour 45 to 2 hours, 2 hours and 10 minutes, and that's your sweet spot. But then you have the outliers. There's always the movies that's 3 hours long, and then you wonder, why couldn't it have edited this a little bit and made it shorter?
Yeah, and then it gets down to the amount of money that the moviegoer is going to spend on popcorn and stuff. So the longer you're there, the more money you're going to spend. And they probably
I don't see a lot of people getting up from their seat and going out to the concession stand halfway through a three-hour movie to get more soda and popcorn. But I suppose some people might.
That's true. And most of my eating is done before the movie even starts. So anyway, usually in the previews. But in telling the stories like the one you have written, writers use narrative and dialogue. You talked about that briefly, to help the reader understand the story better. Which do you favor more in writing? What's your preference, dialogue or narrative, and why?
Oh, well, I'm very much dialogue oriented in my stories. I only want the narration to set up and explain what the characters are doing, and then I try to let the characters then explain what's going on in their heads and in their emotions and their feelings through their dialogue, through their conversations with one another. Narrative is necessary at times to transition from one scene to the next, to make sure that your reader understands that something has changed. We've now gone to a new destination or a new time. But then it's really what happens, who's, going somewhere, doing something in some of my stories, be shooting someone or getting into an altercation with someone. But it's really, my books are probably 70% dialogue.
And do you pay attention to the dialogue tags, I'm sorry, that a lot of writers talk about? There's a lot of in-depth study that goes into explaining and studying and giving lessons on dialogue tags. What's your experience with that?
Well, I try to use as few of them as I possibly can. If there's two characters talking to each other, and it's clear when you move from one paragraph to the next paragraph that it's the other person talking, then you don't need a dialogue tag. The reader can follow along without you having to say who's talking every time the other person speaks. It gets tricky when there's three or four people in the scene, and you really have to identify who is speaking, otherwise it would get confusing. And so you have to sometimes. But I try to keep them to an absolute minimum. I also am very compulsive about the writing in the sense that when I'm done with a draft, before it gets published, I'll do a search for how many times does each word appear in the text. So when I do that, and I'll say, okay, so if the word stammered, for example, occurs 10 times, where 10 times as part of a dialogue tag, I said that someone said something and it described them as stammering. I say, well, that's too many. 10 stammers is too many.
Yeah.
So I'll go back and I'll find those and I'll try to rewrite those a little bit. So that's a little bit too repetitive. But you'll hear the word, if the word said occurs 275 times, that's fine. I mean, that you're going to have to say Tom said or Monica said or Hannah said it's necessary, and you put it in and you hope that the reader never even pays attention to it and just goes on to the next piece of dialogue.
Right. You had mentioned outlining. And I'm wondering, because most of the writers that have been on the show have said that they were the by the seat of their pants writers. They're pantsers, as they say. So I find it interesting that it's interesting that you would be one of the very few who use an outline. Do you always use an outline, or do you just generally use it to try to keep the story going in a certain direction?
Oh, no. Every single time. That's what I will do. And there'll be a timeline and there'll be an outline. And the outline is every scene that's going to be in the story. And the timeline is to try to keep track of when things are happening relative to other things. Like many stories, The Other Murder has three different sets of points of view. You've got the journalists, you've got the pair of police detectives, you've also got another character that I won't talk about on the broadcast. You gotta read that for yourself. So every time you're going back and forth between one point of view and another, you have to make sure that they line up temporally, that sequence of events have to happen in the right order, and it has to make sense that something happened on Tuesday and then something different happened on Wednesday. So the timeline keeps it straight, but the scene outline tells you each event that's going to happen. Now, by the seat of the pants, you might say, okay, I've got a scene, and in this scene, let's say Hannah and Paolo are going to have a conversation about what they both learned in the previous scenes, and they're going to decide whether to take that information to Hannah's managing editor. Okay, that's what the outline says. That's the scene. And then when I sit down to actually start writing the scene, then the dialogue has to come out and the description of what happens, the specifics of what happens. And that, to some extent, you always have to do freehand. It's like, okay, I know these characters, I know what's going to happen, now let me start writing and just sort of see how the scene develops. But the structure of what's going to happen in that scene is in the outline. And most importantly, what the ending of the story is going to be. I mean, you have to know where you're going. You have to know where you're going to finish in order to be able to write the middle. it's in my head. I can't even imagine trying to write a story without being 100% sure of where you're going.
Yeah, there's some writers that will write the ending first because it comes into their imagination. They'll get it down, and then they'll piece everything together after they've got it all figured out, usually on paper, where everything's going to go. It's sort of like fitting the puzzle pieces in, which I find very interesting. Sometimes when I'm laying in bed awake at night, I'll be thinking of a scene, and it won't fit the beginning of the story. It'll fit more in the end of the story, and then I have to make sure I get that down so I don't forget, because I'm going, that's a great scene, that's a great line, or that's great dialogue. And if I don't write it down or whatever, then I'm going to lose it. I'm going to forget what I thought about it 2:30, 3 a.m. in the morning. But anyways, I want to remind everybody out there once again, we're talking to Kevin Chapman that wrote The Other Murder. And I want to remind you that if you're out there live, not dead, of course, but if you're listening to the show live, you can give us a call at area code 914-219-0868. Do not be shy. We don't bite. We don't get a lot of callers to the show, but on occasion we do, and this is your opportunity to give us a call and talk to Kevin. And sounds like a very interesting guy so far, and I don't expect that that'll go away, Kevin. But working, as you were saying, you're also a lawyer. So working as a lawyer makes for a very busy life, I imagine. And when do you find the time to write? What is it like? And do you set goals, and where do you go to write?
Well, I usually go to my couch, to tell you the truth. It's tonight, for example, when we're done with this podcast, I will go upstairs. I'll sit down. My wife will be on the other side of the couch, and we will watch the baseball game or the hockey game or whatever happens to be in the background. And I've got I'm doing the final rewrite of my current book, which is called Double Takedown. It's Mike Stoneman number 6. That goes to my editor at the end of the month, and I'm doing the final revisions after having gotten all my beta reader responses. So I'll be spending 2 hours or so just sitting and going through the story and doing revisions and cleaning things up. That's when I do it. And on a different night, I might be writing a scene of dialogue, or I might be working on the outline for the next book. It's almost always sitting on my couch with the baseball game on, or the hockey game, or the football game, or you know, whatever season it happens to be.
Yeah, I have to lock myself up and turn music on. I can't be distracted. Some people can go to coffee shops and sit down with a million people around them, or like you say, with the television going. I just can't do that. I have to get in the mood of the story, and the only way I can do that is quiet. So that's also interesting in how us writers put together our work. Some of us do it totally different, but it's always interesting to find out what an author does and how they go about doing their writing. And you're just talking a little bit about the editing process, and how is editing, publishing, and marketing gone for you? I mean, you've written several books, and do you have any advice in that process?
Well, I mean, for authors who are just starting out, the advice is be patient. Because it's a slow climb. My first book in this genre, the first thriller, Righteous Assassin, it is very, very, very hard to get a new author's book in front of people and to get them to read it, let alone buy it. And so the concept of making money off of having written a work of fiction, when you're not a famous person who has a built-in audience of millions of followers on your Twitter account, it's not going to happen. I mean, one in a million. Every once in a while, somebody will read your book who's an influencer, and they'll recommend it, and then thousands of people will buy it, and you'll make a lot of money. Every once in a while, you'll pique the interest of somebody, and they'll decide to buy the rights to put it on Netflix. But for 99.5% of us, you write a book and you try to get people to read it, and you try to get people to review it, and then you start working on the second book. And then when you finish the second book, now you got two. So if you can get people to read the first one, now they've got another one that they can read afterwards. And then maybe a third book. And really, it wasn't until I got done with book six that I, for the first time, approaching the point where I'm actually making money. And it is, it's hard. You've got to make a name for yourself. In my case, I'm not even the only Kevin Chapman out there in the world. My books are Kevin G. Chapman,
right.
G for George, my middle initial, because there's another author out there in the world named Kevin Chapman. And
sure.
So I have to make sure I'm distinguishing myself from the other one. And it's I've hired a publicity company to run advertising for my books, and you know I pay them. So when you start running a lot of ads, advertising works. I will tell you that, because when I started paying to run advertising, I got more sales, but I was also spending a lot more money to get those sales, and it's just a process you've got to work at. You got to work at it slowly and over the long term, and I'm hoping that someday I'll get to the point where I'm actually turning a profit at this enterprise, but we're not quite there yet. And I've been doing it pretty regularly since 2018 when Righteous Assassin was published. So just take it slow and don't have too high expectations about making a lot of money in a short period of time. That's not what this business is about.
Yes, and I would also say that, and I think you would agree, that writing itself has to be something that you love doing, not just to make money like any job. Yeah, sure, you need money coming in. And to some, most of us, we get very little money coming in, but we enjoy the process. And even if just one person walks up to you and says, gee, Tom, I loved your book. I mean, it makes you, it turns you into a writing machine for months. If I get that one compliment out there, would you agree with that, Kevin?
I do. I get an unreasonable amount of pleasure when a complete stranger tells me that they read my book and they got some enjoyment out of it and they liked it. I mean, it shouldn't. It really shouldn't make me as happy as it does. But there's something about that reinforcement that, yeah, not only do I like this book and my friends and family, but total strangers who've never met me and just happened to stumble upon my work through a recommendation, or they saw it on Amazon, or they found it in the public library, and they say, oh, I read that, and I really enjoyed it. It does. It drives you forward as you write the next book. But you're right. If you're not enjoying it, if you're not having fun with it, then you're not gonna be a good writer, and you're not going to make money trying to sell a book that you're not enjoying writing.
Did you ever try to sell a book to your courtroom audience?
Well, I don't do a lot of trial work, so that's not happening.
Yeah.
But every once in a while on my professional life, I'll be on a phone call with somebody and they'll say, hey, I Googled you and I see that you're a writer and I looked at your website and hey, those are pretty cool. And, you know, it'll spark conversation that wouldn't otherwise take place just in a normal professional environment. And that's kind of nice too.
Yeah, that's another thing that we love to hear. I Googled you. And then you wonder, okay, what did you find out about me besides my books? Because, you know, in today's world, there's a lot of stuff out there, and sometimes you don't want everybody knowing everything about you, but it's always an interesting line, I Googled you. So...
Well, in my case, there's not a lot of bad stuff out there. When you search for Kevin G. Chapman, you pretty much come up with my writing. And my website is kevingchapman.com. So everybody finds me very easily when they look for me on the internet.
Yes. So the characters in our stories can invade our lives, and they can sometimes dictate when they need attention. What's it like for you, and who was your favorite character in The Other Murder? Because we all have a favorite character.
Well, you're right that, that characters kind of haunt you sometimes, where you're just you're trying to figure out what is going to happen to this person or what makes them tick, and you know what is their going on in their head, and you have to become their head and figure out their psychology and what's going to do it for them. I would say in this particular story, my favorite character is Paolo Richardson, who is the reporter for a small independent online newspaper, who is a journalist because he loves being a journalist, and he used to be idealistic and thought that he was going to save the world, you know, by being a reporter, and he's now a little older, and he's watched his colleagues come up and go on to bigger and better things while he has stayed in his little neighborhood newspaper because he cares about his neighborhood and he cares about the things that are happening and he wants to make sure that people hear the truth and that they get the story. And he's a little bit of an ideal, well, a lot of an idealist. So he's probably my favorite character in the story.
And then Hannah would be a little bit more experienced as being a producer. She is, right?
Well, not she's actually younger than Paolo. But she's more ambitious. She's not in it for the journalistic integrity and the saving the world. She's in it because it's something where she can make some money and she can her star can rise quickly and she's on television as opposed to being in print. You know, if you consider online newspapers to be print, she's in it for other reasons and her motivations are different. But they represent very sort of common themes within the media industry and the difference between being on a cable news show and writing for a newspaper. You've got a very different audience. You've got very different goals and directions. And what the definition of success means to you is very different. And so those two characters are there juxtaposed to one another, but they have to work together and they have to be a team some of the time. And that made for a very interesting relationship. And it's really relationships that what makes stories work. Those are the things that really get me going, is trying to establish relationships between characters and then where are they going and how do they play into the overarching story. That's what makes it the most fun.
What sparked my interest and really kept me reading the story was that in that process of being a reporter, they have to decide, do they tell the truth or do they bend it or do they not tell the truth in telling a story? And I think that happens a lot today. I found that very interesting, and I don't think a lot of people really understand sometimes what a reporter's dealing with. They're also dealing with ratings. You know, they have to make sure that they're putting out something that their audience is going to be interested in. And sometimes they just want to tell the truth regardless of what it does to their careers because that's what they're in the business for. I believe that resides, I won't reveal much of the story right here. I don't want to spoil it, but one of your two characters there, Paolo and Hannah, are involved with that dilemma. And I found that really good.
Thank you. I mean, that's really the core of this story. The tagline on the front of the book says, sometimes the most dangerous thing is the truth.
Yes.
And that's, you know, the heart of the whole issue is, what is the truth? Well, the truth is whatever you think it is, but it's also whatever you tell it. And if you're a viewer and you're watching the television and you see something and you hear somebody tell you something, you assume it's the truth because somebody on the television just told it to you. But is it really the truth? And then you have the dichotomy of, Is it the person who told it to you believe at the time they told it to you that it was the truth? And does that make it true? Well, it makes it true at that moment. But what if it turns out that the truth that they thought was there really turns out to be something else? or that the real facts turned out to be something different. Now, what do you do when you are the reporter who reported it one way the first time? At what point do you admit that you were wrong and tell the story differently? And who makes that decision? And at what point do you have information that you know is true, but it's going to be dangerous for either for you or for somebody else? And is it really important that the reader or the viewer know that fact or that little piece of information? And you as a journalist, what's your responsibility for telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth all the time? And that's what this story is really about. You know, there's a mystery. There's a, you know, there are these two murders. There's an investigation into what really happened. And that's fun and that's entertaining and that's interesting. But wrapped into all of that are these more fundamental questions about the role of journalism in society and the way in which people consume facts that they get from a newspaper or on a cable television show. And what's really going on behind the scenes. So that was a lot of fun for me.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so we all know that we are writers, but we usually do a lot of reading. I read and review over 40 books a year. Do you do a lot of reading? And who are your favorite authors?
I try to. I do review books also on my website. I think I did 18 last year. Which is pretty good considering that I'm spending a lot of time on writing. But my Kindle
lawyering
gets a lot of work. I also have a day job. Yeah. I do a lot of reading for my fellow independent authors. Many of my colleagues and friends that I've met in the writing community, I'll read their books and review them. I do beta reads for other authors too some of the time. When I'm doing something just for myself, I tend towards either nonfiction. I read a lot of nonfiction, history and biography. When I'm reading fiction, I pretty much am either science fiction or in my own world, the mysteries and thrillers. But I read a lot of different kinds of things. I would say my favorite authors are probably Robert Heinlein and Michael Connelly.
Michael Connelly, yes, I do remember him and have read quite a few of his books. Are you... I'm sorry?
No, go ahead.
I was going to say that you do a lot of reading in your genre, as you were saying, but you also read nonfiction too. What would you say? You read more nonfiction than you do fiction?
Probably more fiction, just because, as I said, I'm reading other authors' work, and that's almost all fiction. And so that's probably the majority. But I enjoy different kinds of things. And when you're living in the fantasy world of fiction and murder mysteries, it's kind of nice sometimes to break away from that and read something about real life and historical events, which
yes,
you can also find inspiration in. There's all kinds of things that happen in the world that you can then say, ooh, that's really cool. I should find a way to work that into one of my stories.
Right.
You know? You make a little note, right? And
yeah,
you put it in a folder, and then one day you pull it out and you say, oh, I'm going to have that happen in this book.
As they say, Kevin, write what you know, right?
Well, write about what you know. Try not to do a lot of detailed work on a subject that you're not familiar with.
Right.
I tell you one thing that drives me crazy is writers who write legal scenes, whether it's a courtroom scene or a description of something that's going on with a lawyer, and they get it wrong. It just drives me up the wall as a lawyer. It's like, no, it's not the way it would happen.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fine
myself
to be writing fiction, but your fiction has to be realistic. You know, that's my view.
Yeah, that's a challenge. And, you know, I usually try to do a lot of research in all of my scenes, make sure I get it as close to perfect as I can. Of course, there's that word perfect. I don't think any of us are that, but I try to get it close to that as I can. But here's a subject that always gets our writers' blood boiling a little bit, and it would be reviews, the good and the bad. What's your thoughts?
You know, reviews are a necessary part of the process, and I think that it's good to get bad reviews. I don't say I enjoy reading bad reviews, but I think it's important for a book to have some reviews from people who didn't love it.
Yes.
I think it actually helps the reader who's reading reviews to be able to read the reviews from the people who didn't like the book and say, why did these people not like this book? And am I the kind of reader like them that might not like this book? And that's fine. That's sometimes the way you decide if I'm going to buy a book or read a book is not all the people who said wonderful things about it, but who are the people who said bad things about it? And do those comments resonate with me, or to the contrary, are the things that that person didn't like about the book things that I don't care about or things that I don't think would make me not like the book? So it's fine to get bad reviews. I had a 2-star review written for The Other Murder, and the guy who wrote it actually reached out to me and wrote me an email and explained to me the things that he didn't like about the book and why. And I said, that's great. I really appreciate the fact that you told me these things because it helps me as a writer be able to know for the next time that there are readers out there who feel that way.
Right.
And that's fine. I don't mind that.
Yeah, we need to hear the critical parts of our stories too. Can't all be 5 stars, although some of us would like nothing but 5-star reviews. But that's not realistic. That's really not realistic, as you point out. I think the quantity.
I got to tell
reviews,
I don't give out very many 5-star reviews. You know, when I do my own book reviews, if you get 4 stars from me, that means I really liked your book. I thought it was a solid book, and I enjoyed reading it. That's 4 stars. 5 stars takes a lot of work. You know, I give out maybe 5% of my reviews are 5 stars. I'm a tough grader, so it doesn't bother me.
Yeah. I review on Readsy, and the way they phrase it is a 4-star is I loved it, and a 5-star is a must read. There aren't too many. There aren't too many of them that would say that they would be a must read. I have not run into that, but I do run in quite a few of those in the 40 books that I review. But it's hard to get to that standard, which is okay with me, but. That's the review process. And like you say, bad reviews are always good. I think the quantity is important. The more reviews you get, the better chances that you're going to, you know, somebody's going to pick you up and help you in your career.
Well, that's true. But for any given book, when you look on Amazon and you see the book's got 12 reviews, you immediately think, okay, well, there's not that many people who are very excited about this book, even if all 12 reviews are good. But if it's got 600 reviews, and it's like, well, a lot of people read this book and felt compelled to write a review about it. So that tells me right there that this is maybe worth reading just because there's that many people who took the time to write a review, even if it was just a couple of sentences. Now, if you got 600 reviews and your star rating is 4.5, well, now this is really a good book because nobody's, going to get 5 stars every time over 600 reviews. But if it's 4.4, 4.3 even, that's good. That's really good. So now I'm interested in I'm going to look further at this book.
Exactly. Well, Kevin,
it's hard to get there. It takes time.
It does. And Kevin, we got about 5 minutes left in the broadcast here. And this is what we call your Oscar moment. Any parting words about The Other Murder? And is there anyone you would like to thank for the successes you've had with the book and in life in general?
Well, most of the success that I have with all my books goes partly to my wife, Sharon, who is my I don't want to say co-author, but certainly collaborator on all of these stories. And she helps keep me honest and is really good at the subplots and the character interactions for my characters. So we spend a lot of time talking about the stories and talking about the characters. So she is a tremendous help and inspiration. So she's number one. And I also have to thank my editor, who does such a wonderful job with the editing of the books. She also happens to be my daughter, who's a professional freelance editor, as it turns out. Somehow I bred one. And Samantha M. Chapman Editing, she's terrific. And I owe a lot of my success also to her, because she's not afraid to tell me when things suck. She will yeah. really lay into me and say, no, this does not work. You can't do this. You gotta rewrite this, because this scene just doesn't make any sense. And that's what you need from an editor. So I thank her. I also thank my book cover designer, Peter from Bespoke Book Covers, who's over in Ireland. And he just does such a great job putting together the images that end up on the covers of these books. And although you're not supposed to judge a book by its cover, we know we all kind of do. You have a few seconds to get somebody interested in your book based upon what the cover looks like. And having a good cover designer is just an amazing thing. So I truly, truly thank him. But this has been fun. It's been a fun ride. I really enjoyed writing The Other Murder, and hope that people will read it and then think about it. And you really have to think about it to get it. Even at the very end of this book, I very intentionally at the end left the reader having to decide what they think really happened. And when I say what they think, they have every fact. You have every fact from every point of view, and you're the only one who does, because none of the characters in the book has all of the information from all of the points of view. Only you, the reader, have all of the information. And even having all of the information, you still have to think about what really happened and why do I believe what really happened, and what do I think about that, and how do I feel about that. And if I get you to think about that and to really have some emotional connection to it, then I'm absolutely happy and I feel like I've done my job.
Very good, Kevin. And Kevin G. Chapman, where can our listeners contact you?
You can get me at my website, kevingchapman.com. All the information about my books are there. The books are available as audiobooks, as well as in print and ebooks. If you want to support local bookstores, you can go to bookshop.org, where you can find my books and the books of you know, all of the other independent authors in the world that support sales through local independent bookstores. I'm a very big proponent of bookshop.org. You can find everything there.
Very good. Kevin, it's been a pleasure having you on the Writer's Lounge, and I wish you much success in all the books that you're going to be writing into the future, and really enjoyed the ones you've already put out there. So thank you for being on the show, and have a good night.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here, and great success with your podcast.
Thank you very much. Have a good night. And there goes Kevin G. Chapman. And once again, he wrote The Other Murder. So go ahead and out there and look for that book. It's a great read. I'm sure you will enjoy it. And in 2 weeks, April 15th, Ox DeVere will be here, Rage of the Djinn. A team of excavators restoring Notre Dame makes a stunning discovery beneath the floor of the cathedral, an unmarked sarcophagus. So that's a very interesting read, and I can't wait to have Ox DeVere on the show for that. And until then, I will see you next time on the Writer's Lounge, where I encourage writers and readers to keep the pen in the eyes of the page and to let the story begin. Enjoy yourselves and be well, and have a good night.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper. whisper and look. Secret of the plot. It's just to tell you that I love you a lot.